Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and I have some really big, really exciting news to share with you guys this week. But first, I just want to take a minute to thank everybody who has supported Talk Nerdy over the course of the week by either rating and reviewing on iTunes or Stitcher, by going to my website, karasantamaria.com, and making purchases from the Talk Nerdy store, and by supporting as a patron by going to patreon.com/talknerdy or by clicking through the PayPal links on karasantamaria.com. So I want to give a couple of specific shout outs here. Via the Patreon portal, I want to thank Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. I'm looking here at my records, and over the lifetime of the show, you guys have supported so incredibly much. So I want to thank you for that. Also, some people who have supported a lot over the lifetime, Rob Barcy. Gosh, it's almost too many to mention here. Let's see, Greg Rogers, Kyle Bilheimer, Anthony Roberts, Giovanni Morales, Grant McKinney, Ryan Schauer, I think that's how you pronounce that, Christopher Royce, so many amazing patrons. Thank you guys so very much from the bottom of my heart. I also want to thank, let's see, Stephen Knowles from the UK. I want to thank Will Pattison from New Mexico. And lastly, I want to thank Lars Hellem from Norway. You guys supported and left me some really kind notes over the course of the week. So again, thank you so, so much for that. You guys are amazing. Now, the cat is a little bit out of the bag. You may have noticed if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, or if you were there with us this weekend at TAM, the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. I think it was the 13th and final TAM here this year, 2015, and that is a meeting for the amazing, or I should say with the amazing, James Randi, the magician and skeptic. It's a great meeting of skeptical minds coming together and sharing ideas, and we just learn a lot from one another and get to meet up with some old friends too. Anyway, I'm blabbering because I'm recording this at like 2 a.m. and I'm so tired from being at this conference all weekend, but it was fun. And it was fruitful. And we got to announce at a live recording of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast that I will be joining the guys as their permanent fifth rogue. That's what they call the co-hosts on the podcast. So if you don't already listen to SGU, I really urge you to download it, check it out. I will be on starting this coming Saturday indefinitely. And I'm so excited. I'm so honored to be invited into this very tight-knit family. And I'm really thankful for all of you who have supported me along the way, who have supported Talk Nerdy along the way, because I don't think that I'd be doing this without you. Also, no fear. Talk Nerdy's not going anywhere. I will be continuing this as long as you guys want me to. And so far, your support has meant just so much. All right. Time to move on to the show. I'm really excited about this week's episode. I get to welcome an incredible woman who works very hard on a syndicated radio show that is progressive, that is forward-thinking, and that really focuses on environmental news, politics, and analysis, something that I think has been missing from Talk Nerdy. So I'm thrilled to have her on this week. Here she is, Desi Doyen of the Green News Report. Hey guys, I'm here with Desi Doyen from the Green News Report. I am so excited that you were able to make it. I know we've been trying to schedule it for quite some time. So
I know. And we had to basically start the recording because we keep chatting.
I know. I just started like in the middle. We were halfway through talking about Tom's River, which I haven't read yet, but is in my Q bookshelf. I have a whole bookshelf dedicated to books that I haven't read yet. And another bookshelf of books that I've already read, because I always accidentally will pick up books I've already read and then get, you know, a chapter in and realize I've wasted time. And I was just saying, I just finished, literally last night, I finished The Martian.
Oh my gosh.
It was so good.
Tell me more.
It was so good. You know what? I'm worried that it won't translate to a film as well, because I know it's going to be a movie. And
right.
The people making it are apparently incredible, so I'm sure it'll be great. But the reason the book is so good is it's the character development, it's the dialogue, and it's kind of the way that it's written. Most of the book is written as these journal entries. And so it's the way that he writes in his journal, which to me is not compelling film. It's compelling.
Well, yeah, because it's hard to demonstrate someone's thought process.
Exactly. And a whole movie of just like internal monologue doesn't seem like it would be that interesting.
But it is Matt Damon, so, you know, he's
pretty good.
Maybe
it'll work. Maybe it'll work, yeah.
It's because they don't give away anything. No spoilers.
I won't. But I think the best part with this isn't a spoiler at all, is how if you're, like, really scientifically minded, you can read it. If you're not that scientifically minded, you can read it. It's just as good because there will be, like, let's say 2 pages dedicated to him working out calculations about how he's going to hydrolyze water or something like that. Oh. Well, I've got to do this, and the water reclaimer makes this much, and then this many kilowatt hours to blah, blah, blah. And it's all specific and really technical, and you're like kind of starting your eyes, just when your eyes are sort of starting to cross, they'll be like, trust me on the math. Fuck it. I'm a really good engineer. And you're like,
well,
good.
That's a clever device.
It's really
smart. Sort of sets you into the thought process that a scientist has to go through as they're thinking through, how am I going to address this problem or this issue or this question that I have? And I think it also has other, you know, fiction has a great way of putting us into the shoes of somebody who is going through something. And, you know, that's a really generic way of saying it. But when we're looking at things like climate change and global warming, there was this big story that I just read about in grist.org, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Great website, by the way. And he was talking about climate fiction. Cli-fi is what they're calling it for short.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, there's a lot more. There are more books coming out now that are dealing with not just, you know, what we usually see in the movies, like dystopian futures. You know, we see Hunger Games and we say Divergent. You know, these are young teen movies where the teen girl goes in and saves the world. And they're set in places that are, I think, look clearly like they've been climate changed. It is a climate changed future.
Yeah.
And it sort of puts people into the position of, gosh, this is what it could feel like and be like to be a person in that world, and sort of, you know, puts these scientific warnings that we're hearing into some kind of context, a human context.
Yeah. And I think especially for, you know, young people who those movies, specifically those kind of teen,
definitely.
I guess you'd call them like suspense thriller, coming of age, like all, it's like everything. It's a genre, or it's a drama, it's a comedy. But all of those films, you know, their core audience, which is really spread because I know plenty of women in their 30s and 40s who still like those movies, but their core audience is thinking about these things.
Yeah.
You know what? They are the ones who I think much more have their finger on the pulse of what's going on. It's grandma, it's grandpa, it's mom, it's dad. It's even some people around our age that are the ones that are really resistant. But the little brothers and sisters, the kids, they're like freaked out.
They're noticing. They're noticing. They know what's happening. And, you know, it's when I talk to my nephews who are in high school right now about what they're learning in school, you know, this is just a part of the curriculum. This is a foregone conclusion that this is happening. There's none of this question like you see a lot in Texas, for example, where we are both from, where, you know, there are moves in the Texas legislature to change the textbooks so that they try to force the idea that, oh, hey, you have to teach about these natural causes behind global warming and climate change. You know, you have to make sure that kids realize that there's some question about the science. And of course there isn't.
Yeah.
You know, there is no question. There is a global scientific consensus about all of this.
No, and it's the teach the controversy thing that we've been seeing since, you know, the 1800s with evolution.
Right.
They're just repackaging it for climate change.
Yeah. And it has, obviously it has long-term consequences, and it is something that I am gladdened to see that, you know, kids in high school are hearing about this, and kids in elementary school, that they are folding this into the curriculum for those places that haven't folded it into the curriculum already. You know, and that brings me to, you know, thinking about the network of climate think tanks, you know, the sort of AstroTurf network that's basically funded by the fossil fuel industry, and those, you know, who have standing in keeping things exactly as they are. You know, they're actually funding school curriculum that they then offer freely to schools to help them have a very broad and, you know, general way of teaching climate science so that children can have a fuller understanding of all the questions. And, you know, it's like that's, they have that kind of access, and there's really nobody to stop them but the school district, the principals, and the teachers themselves to stop and say, that's wrong. No, please don't put that in my textbook.
And oftentimes they're not in a position to do that because either the legislature is trying to work to have laws that force them to integrate that, or, you know, we're dealing with school districts that are so incredibly poor that these kinds of teaching materials, quote unquote, and these curriculum, you know, plans that they don't have to do on their own are kind of welcome, unfortunately, yeah. You know?
Because they don't have the money.
They don't have the money. They don't have the, you know, they don't have the manpower to make them themselves. And yeah, it's like, oh, here are, you know, here's a, you know, multi-part DVD series that you can show, and it takes up weeks of your classroom. It's like, oh my God, thank God.
And it keeps the kids interested because, you know, it's video and yeah.
But sponsored by ExxonMobil. Right. You know, and that's the thing that I think, I know we all realize in the back of our minds, but we don't always bring to the surface, is when we talk about the kind of air of climate denialism, and we think about our crazy uncle, or we think about, you know, the politicians that are saying these things, it's not something where there are just people who aren't hip to the science. It's not something where, oh, it's just because they're Republican and that they have a different mindset and they're more conservative in their thinking. There is an orchestrated, financially based machine is working very hard to ensure that the easiest answer for most of America is this kind of climate denialism answer. Yeah. You know, to make sure that this seems like it's scientifically based, to make sure that it seems like it's truth, and to try and somehow twist this corporate financial incentive into something that is understandable to the general public as a benefit for them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And somehow they've been very successful at this.
Well, that's the power of money.
Yeah. You know, and it's basically the power of marketing. And yeah. This is something that we often see, is that on the, and I can't even call this a conservative or I can call it a conservative versus a progressive issue, I suppose. I can't call it a Republican versus a Democratic issue, because all the major Democrats are on the payroll too. I mean, this is something where we don't see much of a difference between, you know, cowering to big oil across party lines. I would say that the more progressive people are, the more environmentalist they tend to be.
Yes.
And, you know, there's variations there, and there's always exceptions to those rules. But it's something that, you know, there's such a financial incentive there. And as we were saying, it's a marketing ploy that just historically I feel like the progressive politicians, and specifically the Democratic Party, just suck at PR.
Oh my God, yes.
Why are the Republicans so much better at PR?
You know, that I don't know. I think it has to do with, you know, they've done the cognitive studies, you know, mm-hmm. on how different people have different major characteristics that tend to make them fall into different tribes. You know, the authoritarian, individualistic, the communitarian, egalitarian, mm-hmm. You know, so they fall on a spectrum among these different characteristics. And so it does seem to be that folks who are more in that authoritarian mindset tend to be more aggressive, less that they tend to go with their gut feeling more. They don't want to think too deeply about the implications of, you know, the consequences of their individualism. You know, it's individualism above all. And that tends to lend itself, it seems to me, towards mm-hmm. being more aggressive and better at, you know, the gut punch, five-word tagline that really resonates with people, versus, you know, that you know, Democrats, liberals, progressives tend to go into that communitarian, egalitarian mindset where let's talk about this. You know, let's talk about the impacts that it has on
people.
We're
like Canadians.
Let's all be nice. Yeah. We're a little too nice about it.
You know, it's funny. So basically, it may not be the case that they're just that much better at marketing. It may be the case that their constituency is more likely to be affected by that marketing, yeah. which is interesting.
And most people, you know, when you think about how generally folks in America today, you know, everybody's really busy. You know, they're working a very difficult job. They're raising kids. They're mm-hmm. paying their mortgage. They're trying to make enough money for retirement, trying to make enough money to, you know, just to get through the day. And they don't have the extra time to delve into these subjects. So, you know, throwing more facts and nuance at them doesn't really, they don't really have time for that.
No.
So when you have that somebody who's got that gut punch, you know, one sentence thing that sows uncertainty, you know, that no, scientists aren't necessarily sure about this. And of course, that's not true. But that tends to be the thing that hits and that they do hear. And it's also repeated over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, because they have their own industry funded scientists and they can say, look, this is somebody in the scientific community who doesn't agree with the mainstream, or they don't even call it the mainstream. This is somebody who shows you that there's, you know, still confusion amongst the data. It's true. And I think that, you know, we've made mistakes on the Democrat. I say we, I'm not a Democrat. I'm like so much more liberal
than
the Democrats.
Yeah, but on the science side, let's
on
say.
On that side, exactly. I mean, I think Obama made a massive mistake during his push for Obamacare when he didn't just call it Medicare for All. Like when he didn't just stick to these simple taglines. You know, it's like he's sitting here making it really nuanced and it's, you know, sits really well for a certain percentage of people. But all these people that are still kind of on the fence about it, that would have been so powerful. And then you go to the other side and they're like, but the death panels.
Right.
And all of a sudden you're like, oh, fuck.
And so you have this very natural tendency of, you know, basically two different sort of personality poles. And then you have the way that our media is set up, which is, you know, it's based on money and profit and ratings. And so, you know, nuance does not get you ratings. Nuance doesn't get you eyeballs. And then you have this network of fossil fuel funded denial groups, astroturf groups, think tanks that are there and are paid specifically to sow uncertainty and doubt. So you have, I think, several different, and also you have, you know, Americans who are very happy with the easy lifestyle that we have right now.
Totally.
And who are totally convincible that they're going to be required to live in burlap sacks in the dark and cold, which of course is not true, but that's a really easy image to get across to people. So you have sort of this nexus of all these different things that are embedded in our society right now that have created, you know, where we are today, which is, you know, on the precipice of a really shitty time. I can say that, right?
You can totally say that.
So really shitty, you know, we're on the really shitty precipice right now where you have some scientists saying, oh, hey, dude, what does it matter whether we go over the cliff on a Wednesday or a Thursday?
Yeah.
Same thing.
Well, and there are a lot of people who are saying we're already over the cliff. So at this point, we're not going to get back up there. Let's just mitigate. We can't prevent. We can't change.
Of course, you know, that's not entirely true either. So, you know, you have the search for, I think, easy answers easily fits into this network, this nexus of all of these different threads of society that are all kind of coming together at the same time to put us at a very, you know, at a fork in the road. You know, where do we go from here? And how do we take what we know needs to happen, you know, in a certain group of people, understand, you know, where we need to go with this, and everybody else who has no clue, you know, what really is going on, and they're a little too busy right now to be able to hear about it because they've got to pay the bills today.
And how do you make it even remotely interesting when it just tends to come across as gloom and doom, gloom and doom? Like, it's so depressing. It's the same reason that people don't have any idea what's going on in Syria. They have no, because you just, at a certain point, you're like, threshold reached, too sad, can't watch anymore, and then
let's
you
go
end
look
up,
for cat videos.
Exactly, and then you end up not being aware, and it's like, can you really blame people for that?
Oh, certainly not.
Yeah, it's not like I'm sitting here saying that because that's just, ugh, it's so, you know, only the dummies. No, it's like I do that.
Yeah.
It's like I can only handle reading so much about ISIS.
Yeah.
And seeing so many, you know, no, I don't want to watch another beheading video. No, it's depressing. You know, I was really interested when I had Chris Mooney on the podcast recently.
He's amazing.
And, you know.
And adorable.
Adorable, too. And his book, Unscientific America, I think really was instrumental for me in my kind of in my journey and in my development as a science communicator.
Really?
And because I think that he just did such a good job of laying out, he and his co-writer actually, of laying out this idea that, like, the deficit model does not work. The reason that people don't, you know, always trust scientists, the reason that people don't know sometimes what we think of as basic scientific principles is not because we haven't shared them with them enough. It's because our approaches aren't
appropriate for reaching the public because of all the things that you just said. Yeah. You know, they're busy. They have other things on their mind.
They have limited bandwidth.
They have limited bandwidth, and we can't
to be able to focus on this particular very important but seemingly, you know, distant thing.
Exactly. And emotionally, like, it's just not a feel-good topic, and I think that makes it much harder to be able to discuss, like you were talking about, having film that has that as a backdrop and fiction as opposed to nonfiction. These are all things that we can do. But I was really interested when I had him on the podcast recently because he recently moved over from Mother Jones, which we know is a super like liberal outlet, to the Washington Post, which is very conservative. And not that his tune was changed at all, but the way that he was speaking was really different. For example, he no longer uses the term climate denier.
I did not notice that.
I think he uses the term, it's something like climate...
Is he a skeptic?
Skeptic.
Okay.
Or, I was going to say questioner. It's climate skeptic. And I think the reason for that is he can't turn off his own readers. He has to figure out how to write about these issues, and he feels the same as he ever did, but how to write about them in such a way that appeals to the base that usually isn't reading this. And one thing that was really interesting that we discussed was how there's more and more psychological studies. Like you were talking about the studies that show that sometimes we have these intrinsic personality types and these different biases, and they make us, you know, respond better to authority or not authority and blah, blah, blah. And he was also talking about the way that, you know, there are environmentalists on both sides of the spectrum.
Yes.
He might even argue that people who are really conservative are just as concerned about the environment as people who are really liberal, but their approach to it has to be different. The last thing you can do is preach to a conservative from like a hippie kind of place because they're going to be like, ugh.
Yeah.
Don't talk to me like that. Okay, I'm now no longer interested in what you have to say.
I'm now actively against whatever you say.
But if you show them the financial incentives and if you show them the kind of personal responsibility component of it, you actually can form this really strong environmental movement on that side. The problem is we never thought about that before. We thought of a one-size-fits-all method, message, like carry around your reusable bag, guys, and you'll be helping the planet and give it a big hug. And they're like, ugh, fuck that.
You know, and it's exactly that. Because, you know, what you find is that I think it's tribalism, you know, and that was one of the things that I think Chris writes exceptionally well about. The tribalism, you know, that you tend to believe people in your tribe. And if your people in your tribe don't agree with that tribe, then that tribe is the other. And then anything they say is suspect.
Yeah, and even if they then start to talk about something else that you would have
agreed on. That's a
similar
value that you have. You know, even if it's the same value, you still reject what they say because they are the other tribe. And I think that there was a lot of that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s.
And we all have it,
too. Like, you know, like hippies. Hippies who would denigrate Christians.
Yeah.
You know, folks who denigrate folks who have a specific, you know, Christian or spiritual approach to life. And it's like, God, how can you be so stupid? I mean, obviously, your friend in the sky is not really going to help you with any of this stuff. And that is a similar sort of, you know, way of preventing these tribes from talking to each other. And now we're sort of seeing, it helps if we do find where our common values are. You know, there's a whole big movement called Creation Care, which is evangelicals, Christians who are who look at the Bible, who look at Genesis and say, you know, we're not here to exploit and destroy. We're here to be stewards and to care for. And so with the Pope's encyclical that came out last month, that has sort of opened up the floodgates for the Christian evangelical creation care movement to step up. It's sort of given them an opening. They've been around for, you know, 10 or 15 years.
But we, of course, aren't even aware of that.
Right.
And that's what's evangelicals so in this country.
I had no idea. And then I started looking at it. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, there's a whole creation care network and the Evangelical Environmental Network. We interviewed one of their president a couple of weeks ago. And he talks about, you know, he says, look, we can step out of the politics of this. We can step away from, you know, the fear. We can address the fears that people have with our values. Our values are what will translate across these tribal lines. And then you get into, with the tribes, you get into how do we talk to people who are not in our same tribe? How do we convince these people when we have what is essentially a planetary emergency that we're facing? How do we convince them to come along with us so that we can, you know, get this thing addressed and get this taken care of and move on to the future that we could have, you know, the great future versus the really scary future?
And that's not easy. It's not easy. But we're all victim to it.
But this is, I think, where folks like the Creation Care movement can come in, where Republicans, conservatives who remember the old conservatives of the 70s and 80s were actually about conservation, used to be, or, 50s and 60s conservation, traditional conservatism. They basically are saying what you need is a trusted member of that tribe. Once that trusted member of that tribe then shifts and comes about and goes into their tribe and says, here's what's happening. Here's what we need to do. You trust me. I wouldn't lie to you about this. This is important. Here's how we can join into this fight.
Who do you think that could be, though? And the Republican
The Pope
front.
Is a start, but obviously we've seen what has happened to him. You know, he's been vilified and called a Marxist and any number of
things.
I know. It's so crazy.
And, but like here, let's say that we're looking at, for example, all of the Republican candidates for the upcoming presidential election.
Got a long way to
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
Only like, just started.
Who
Another
could
18
be
months.
This? You know, who could do this? I'm afraid that it wouldn't be, you know, your Rand Pauls. It wouldn't be your kind of new libertarians because unfortunately these are the hardest people in that.
Their tribe is against any kind of government action.
Exactly.
And the irony of it is that by delaying action because you don't like government action, you're going to actually set up the conditions under which government action is not only going to be necessary, but essential to survival.
Oh, completely. Yeah,
so
you're going to...
They're setting up exactly the thing that they don't want.
You're going to marshal in martial law.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to need it if we cut all regulation.
Right.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But I guess it's one of those things where you're right, like... It's so hard for us not to be tribal. It's so hard for me, for example.
Well, it's part of our evolution. It's how we survived as a species. Tribal, you know, your tribe, your community helped you survive in the harsh conditions. So,
like when Donald Trump says anything, I can't help but feel like, first of all, it's hilarious.
Yes.
But then I feel really gross inside. And then so if he ever came out publicly and said something that I really agreed with, maybe I would feel that it would be a good writing point. I could write an article about Donald Trump said something smart for once. But for the most part, you're right. It's like he says anything and I'm like, Jesus Christ. And I belittle it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help but do that.
And but it's Donald Trump. We should find somebody. Well, you know, okay. So like you're asking about different candidates. So the vast majority of the Republican candidates, and there are 14 so far, there's going to be a couple more, maybe as many as 17, 18, God knows how far they're going to get. But, you know, they basically follow along two different lines. You know, the first one is it's not happening. The second is it's happening, but it's not us. So that's where we are right now.
Is there anybody who's running who even has a history of admitting, you know, climate change is something that we should be concerned about, that we should be focusing some of our kind of economy on, and maybe they've flip-flopped since then as they've been running? But is there somebody who, if you go far enough back,
you could be sane? I think Marco Rubio.
Yeah,
he's now in the I am not a scientist stage.
Oh, you're so, right. I remember
back in 2008 when he first ran for Senate, he actually acknowledged climate change and that we should do something about it, but we should be smart about it. And then he's flip-flopped on that. So now he's we're not so sure it's going to be bad. It could be good, we need to address our economy first before we even think about these things.
But he's not one of those like trees like CO2 people, is he?
No, he's not an outright denier.
Okay.
Jeb Bush similarly has acknowledged that climate change is happening. He used to acknowledge that, you know, humans were a part of it, but now he's backed off of that to say there's a question about, you know, how much human involvement is. So the only one who currently is running for president officially who has actually acknowledged that, you know, climate change is real, it's human caused, and it's bad, and we need to do something about it is Lindsey Graham. Mm-hmm. But his idea of doing something about it is to first deal with everything else. In other words, to delay, you know, and Chris Christie actually has in the past acknowledged, you know, humans cause it, it's bad, we need to do something. But again, once they get to the point of, well, what policies would you advocate? Would you advocate a price on carbon? You know, Lindsey Graham in the Senate was actually behind the cap and trade bill in 2009. He eventually pulled his support and it failed. So,
I mean, it was originally a Republican plan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and there's this is where we are right now. We're to the place where we really need to be discussing the different policies that we can take, the different policy approaches. And there are many, and they have all kinds of cool and neat things that they do. And each mechanism does a different thing to a different part of a different sector. But what we are not doing right now is discussing those policies. We're still stuck on, you know, hearing Lindsey Graham say, yeah, you know, it's something and it's real. We need to talk about how to do it, but we need to get our economy in shape first. That's delay. And to me, after all these years of covering this, delay is to deny.
Yeah. Oh, completely. And isn't that part of getting the economy in shape?
Yeah. You know, it would be the second internet revolution, essentially, you know. So first we have the internet that changed everything, and this is going to be the second thing. And it is already happening, and I don't think can be prevented from happening now. I think now we are now on the path to clean energy. It's just a matter of how fast, but it is, I believe, inevitable at this time.
But I guess the big fear for me is that if we were to look at the, what did we say? Is it 16? How many?
Declared right now is 14, geez. And it looks like it's going to be 17.
That's so insane.
Unless somebody else comes and starts deciding that they want to run.
Yeah. So if we look at the 14 plus or minus 5 candidates right now, and we, you know, we can look at their track record and we can look at their history of climate denialism, and we can see, you know, who seems to be really entrenched, who seems to be trying to play to the constituency. But if we look at their history of campaign donations and we see who really is in the pocket of the oil industry, it's not that different on the Democratic side, is it? Like, that's the scary thing. We can sit here all day and talk about how the Republican candidates are crazy and the Republican candidates don't give a shit. But like, how much oil money has Hillary Clinton taken over the years?
Right.
Like, I would be interested to see how, is she going to make any change that's any different?
Well, see, I think we're in a really interesting place. Mm-hmm. You know, with Hillary Clinton, I have no idea where she's going to go with this, but she does seem to be pulled to the left by Bernie Sanders, and she is...
At least during the primaries.
Yeah. You know, and as Secretary of State, I know that she has access to the projections of what's going to happen, what's projected to happen, I should say, with displacement of populations, with sea level rise.
She sees
and all
the dire shit so, long before we
yeah,
do.
Yeah, so she knows what's in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. She knows what's projected to be in the pipeline, and so I don't think that she is... not cognizant of that fact. I don't think she, I think there's probably a very fine pathway that she's going to have to walk if she wants to be both the Democratic nominee and actually win the general election. You know, that path between not scaring people that their lifestyles are going to change a great deal because Americans are very protective of their lifestyle, but also acknowledging that, you know, there are some things that we have to do. She's already pledged that she is going to continue with all of President Obama's initiatives that he's done so far, like the Clean Power Plan. That's that huge nationwide state-by-state regulation that's going to, you know, tell each state how much they have to cut their carbon emissions based on, you know, the renewable resources that they can tap, specifically tailored to each state. You know, what do they already use as far as their current infrastructure for energy generation? You know, the Clean Power Plan is hugely comprehensive and it's incredibly detailed for each state. And it's a really good plan.
And is it a hard line in the sand, or can these different states continue to like buy credits and
well, no, it's much
it.
Less on the credit thing.
That's
and that's
good.
A really good thing
yeah,
because,
that's very
you know,
good.
The carbon credits is not really a good way to go.
No, it's, because everybody's going to figure out how to beat the system.
Right. It's too easy to game, and it already has been gamed, which the Europeans, you know, thank you very much, Europe, you went through that first, figured it out, and now we know, don't go there.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's part of the problem with the United States not being really deeply involved in this policy discussion. Other countries are the laboratories for this, and we are going to be the beneficiaries of their victories and mistakes, but with us involved, with the United States involved, and the might that we have with our entire scientific community and our research and development infrastructure, you know, and the way that we can do this, we really could change very rapidly the kind of policy investigations that will help us understand, you know, the best and fastest and most efficient ways to deal with the resources that we have and to get on the path that we need to be. But we're not really having that conversation right now. And, you know, and like, okay, so with the interior bill that was pulled in the House with the Confederate flag amendment,
yes,
you know, that was a really shitty bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it cut the EPA's funding by like 10%. And it told the states to completely ignore the Clean Power Plan by the president. So, you know, when you have a Congress that is run by Republicans who are actively trying to dismantle everything that we're trying to build as we're trying to build it,
yeah.
You know, we have a deeper problem than what's just happening with the presidential campaign.
Well, and we forget that. I mean, I think that we are so primarily focused on like a one leader kind of structure that we forget how limited the executive branch really is and how it's the legislature that makes the real decisions here. And that's why it's so important that we be involved in those votes for the House and for the Senate, that we really think about getting our representatives elected, because they're ultimately going to be the ones that make the laws.
Yeah, that make these policies.
Yes, that make these policies. And you know, we forget that. But it could be as simple, just like you were talking about, you know, America, I think, has a history of having a very strong isolationist kind of view of the world. Like,
yeah.
we're over here, we're a little separate, and we're kind of doubly fucked in this because we are one of the major sources of carbon emissions.
Yep.
We're one of the major causal factors in this like huge increase in greenhouse gases, but we're a bit protected because we are such a wealthy nation.
Yeah.
We're a bit protected from the outcome of it. So it's really sad that you see, you know, between, I'd say, even in China, even in places where I think, and India, where we're starting to see more economic boom and we're starting to see more, for example, cars on the road, more factory farming starting to take place, and they're starting to contribute in greater numbers, which is really scary because as they really develop, the billions of people that live there could see a big change. They still have huge sections of the population that are living in abject poverty.
Yeah.
And so they feel climate change.
Oh, the climate change is going to hit the poor of the world first.
It
and
already
worst.
Is. Yeah. I mean, go to Bangladesh if you don't think that climate change is actually having an effect right now, and see how people are having to leave their homes and come more and more inland because they're living in floodplains. And we just don't see that here. And that's like this huge bummer because it's kind of hard to get through to people who are like, but what do you mean? I can just turn a switch and then water flows freely from my tap.
Well, you know, and there was this weird study that I read about a couple of years ago, and I wish I could remember off the top of my head, but you can go find it somewhere, I'm very sure.
Yeah.
Basically where they presented a scenario to a certain segment of Americans in this particular study. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, so here's a thing, and it's a family, and they have little kids, and bad things are happening to them because of the environment. And what they did was that they would set the family somewhere like in Bangladesh or mm-hmm. India. And then they set the family somewhere over in like California. And then they set the family, you know, in the farming community of your state.
Yeah.
And they found a very, very strong correlation between the distance away from the survey person and how much they gave a shit.
Yeah, yeah, tribalism.
They could
right
care
there.
Less about mm-hmm. somebody in Bangladesh, somebody in California. But if it was somebody in, you know, the farming community next door, then suddenly they wanted to help or suddenly they cared about it. So, you know, we want people to understand that, yes, there are people in Bangladesh. There are folks actually here in the United States
yeah.
who live within 1 meter of sea level rise who are going to have to move based on what it looks like the sea level rise is already baked in.
Yeah.
You know, and there was this big study that just came out in Science Magazine that said, looks like we're locked into 20 feet of sea level rise for sure. Because when you look back at analogs in the geologic past, last time carbon dioxide levels were 400 parts per million in the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
sea levels were like 40 feet higher.
Jesus.
So clearly we're not in equilibrium at the moment, because in the past, when there was time for the gyrations, the mm-hmm. perturbations in the system to settle out into equilibrium, that's where sea levels were. And so when we're here, we're like, okay, clearly we're in some kind, we're not in equilibrium now, and we have not yet seen how the glaciers and the ice sheets respond. We're trying to track a moving system. We're learning how to track a moving system as it's moving.
And to predict the acceleration, like it's so scary how certain changes actually accelerate further change.
Yeah.
You know, as the glaciers, as the actual sea ice, or I'm sorry, as the actual land ice is melting into the sea, then you're releasing all of these gases that then cause the land
from
ice
the permafrost
to, exactly, to like continue to melt, and you start to see this kind of negative feedback loop, which is really scary. So it's going to be quite a while.
Yeah, when you have triggers that trigger other triggers that then trigger other trigger feedback.
So it's going to take a long time until we hit an equilibrium point, but that's only going to happen if we make massive changes, policy changes now, because equilibrium only exists, like you only hit that kind of that homeostatic place when you're not continuing to pump greenhouse gases.
Yeah, when you don't, when you stop the inputs,
yes,
then you can get to equilibrium. But right now, we're still we are the biggest carbon pulse into the atmosphere since, I don't know, the Siberian traps. You know, it's like, I forget how, like 250 million years ago is something where like all of Siberia opened up and the volcanoes erupted for millions and millions and millions and millions of years. And that led to one of the biggest extinctions of all life on Earth. You know, it was like 95% of all species went extinct. And, you know, that's a pretty big deal. It's not going to happen like that, thank goodness. But
no,
we're
but
talking
we
about a very rapid pulse, and there will be consequences
in
for
geologic
that.
Time, guys. This is like a blink of an eye. Like, we forget that because it feels like a long time to us.
Right.
But we are a blip in geologic time, and we really are on the precipice of this sixth extinction, of this major... We see it, I mean... the species loss that we're dealing with right now. And it's not just because of climate change. I mean, this is an additional kind of
factor. It is the predominance of one species across the earth.
Yes.
And, you know, nature has a really nasty way of dealing with species that overstep their biosphere,
and it's going to have to be nastier.
Habitat.
Yes, and it's going to have to be nastier and nastier than examples that we've seen in the past. Because in the past, that species that was overstepping, that was invasive, that was taking over, didn't have advanced tools.
Yeah,
didn't have the ability to co-opt nature and use it to their advantage. We have all of these amazing ways that we can go, well, fuck you, nature, I'm taking over, which means that the equilibration point is going to be that much stronger on the other side. And yeah, I don't think nature's ever going to be able to fight back and keep up the way that we can, unless what we're talking about is basically a planet that is not habitable to us anymore.
It's
a planet that's existing outside of the very, we have a very small range that our blood pH can be, that our ambient temperatures can be, that the amount of water that we have available to each person can be. And once we go outside of that range, we can't exist anymore. Like, we cannot sustain life. And so when Earth becomes inhabitable in that way, there's not enough dry land, there's not enough drinkable water, it's too hot, it's physically too hot outside that no shelter can protect us, and the gas content in the air is one that we can no longer process with our lungs, that our blood can't handle, that our brains can't handle. What the fuck else do we do? This is why books like The Martian are, you know, I think really hit you at this very personal place right now. They resonate. It's because we don't know how much longer Earth is going to be habitable because of what fucking we're doing to it.
I know. No, but see, here's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some good news in this.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are looking at, you know, these studies that say, oh, you know, the sea level rise, we've already baked in probably at least 20 feet, mm-hmm. you know, by 2100 or so, which means, you know, major pullback of major cities, you know, lots of migration and refugees, and that's huge displacement of populations. It's also meaning, you know, weather changes, you know, weather patterns, crop failures, et cetera. So, you know, we have a very big unhappy future ahead mm-hmm. of us unless we take action now. And here's the thing, we can take action. You know, it's not like orbital mechanics where, oh, you know, sorry, the Earth is moving to a place, you know, it's going to tilt and there is nothing you can do.
Yeah.
There is no fulcrum big enough to change the tilt of the Earth. Humanity is going to go extinct. We are not in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the situation where we can say, oh, we can stop pumping CO2 in the atmosphere. We can switch to renewable energy, and we can do that. There are ways. Yeah, it's not going to be easy, but, you know, we can take what we have today, and with the tools we already have in hand, we can solve this problem. So we are very lucky. Yes, we caused the problem, but because it's a human-caused problem, it's a man-made problem, there is a man-made solution to this. We are not dead in the water just waiting for disaster to strike. We can do something.
And I think we should be celebrating the fact that in many communities and at the individual level, so many people are doing something.
Yeah.
Like, we sometimes forget that there are massive wind farms and solar farms, and there are plastic bag bans, and there are, like, there are major policy changes that are taking place. There are carbon emissions being capped. There are massive incentives for people to make personal decisions. You know, I lease an electric car, and I got a fuck ton of money from the government to do it.
Yay.
So, it was one of those things where it was like, it was both exciting because I was doing something that I thought was good for the environment, and exciting because I was like, holy crap, this is like kind of okay for my pocketbook too, you know? And I think that that's really great. And I think we're seeing that more and more.
Yeah, just not fast enough.
It's not fast enough. And that's my fear, not to sound really dire and not to be crippled by fear or anything. My fear is that we're just not, it hasn't sunk in yet.
Yeah.
How incredibly dire things are, because it's one thing that I think that politically, or maybe even I should say personally, humans don't have a good capacity for. And possibly it has to do with how our brains evolved to have like just a real fight or flight kind of system built in. You know, we have this sympathetic nervous system that historically was really necessary for us. That we're in danger, get out of it. We're starving, feed ourselves. And everything has like an immediacy, which is why I think that it's been so easy to sell kind of social media that's very immediate. And it's been easy to sell this sort of YouTube generation and, you know, movies on demand and order Amazon Fresh, and all of these things just make a lot of sense to us, and we're impatient otherwise. We're sort of hardwired for that. And so what we're very bad at doing is making the distinction between an action that I have now will have an effect 15 years from now. It's just, if I don't have immediate gratification, I'm not necessarily going to see that connection.
Yeah.
And no amount of kind of information seems to help people feel it.
Right.
And so the sad thing is, I think it's really a function of having to feel the difference.
That's where the values come in. You know, that's where there's, you know, folks that write about this and are in the clean energy world, for example, they're sort of starting to take all of this information about how people think, how people feel, you know, how are we hardwired evolutionarily, and saying, okay, well, obviously, the deficit model, more information, throwing more information at people is not helping.
It's so, actually sometimes making it worse.
Actually, yeah. Yes. And how we then translate that. And that's, I think, where we see this bridge with the evangelical folks, because they've been saying all along, hey, guys, we need to talk about values. We all want clean air. We all want water, clean water. If you know, they are the ones that are saying, look, if you tell people how important these things are, and purity and nature are very important to you, you
and
know,
children and family.
And children and family, you know, and what do you want your children to have? Don't you want them to be able to see, you know, Glacier National Park like you did when you were a kid? Don't you want that for your child? And so, you know, making it personal, you know, to things that will directly affect them or directly affect their children. You know, there are, of course, going to be there's a certain segment of the population that will never be reached no matter what, because they are not interested in anything that they perceive ideologically to be outside of theirs. But
I don't think they're the big problem. I really don't. I think that they're a minority.
The vast middle.
Yeah, it's the vast middle. And really what it is I think we have to have a two-pronged approach of, as you were talking about, working very hard to kind of bridge the gap between these different tribal groups so that they can find common ground and work together at least in those areas. And at the same time, we need to be making a strong political push to expose the politicians that don't have values, the ones that are not value driven, that are only financially driven, and show that money is not the end all be all. And also, I think in some ways, kind of I don't know. Like, I think it's important to also be in parallel really fighting for campaign finance reform. Well, I think that we can never forget about that right. prong, because it's a foundational block.
Yeah. And so here we are. So you mm-hmm. can't see what I'm doing right here. but here we are. We have this foundation. We have mm-hmm. this foundation of campaign finance. And nothing happens. Well, that's not true. Nothing is not the right word. Few things mm-hmm. can get through this block of campaign finance. What gets to reverse engineer? How do we get rid of campaign finance? Well, we have to get the people into office who can then change the laws.
That's true. You know,
put in the Supreme Court justices onto the U.S. Supreme Court and the state Supreme Courts. How do we get that? We get the people in office who can change the policies, put in the right policies, you know, elect the right people, appoint the right judges.
And this has to be at every level of government, too.
At every level of government, local government, your local school board, mm-hmm. your state school board, like we were talking about in Texas, you know, where they're changing the textbooks because Texas is a massive school book market. So they kind of dictate to the rest of the country what is going to be in the textbooks, you know, in California's. But anyway.
But Texas does have what's that one, just to interject, what's that one documentary? It was so good, and PBS aired it for a while, and it was called The Revisionists. No, yes. The Revisionaries.
Okay, there you go.
Watch The Revisionaries if you want to learn about how much the Texas school board has kind of a stranglehold on education throughout the country. Anyway, moving on.
So we have this filter, this gate, mm-hmm. this block, this wall, and that's campaign finance. Yeah. And to get that dismantled, we have to get people in office who can then change those things. To get those people in office, we have to vote.
Yes.
To vote, you have to register. Not just you, but every single person you know mm-hmm. needs to be registered, needs to make sure that they know what they need when it comes time to show up to vote. Because, you know, also one of the other things that we do at bradblog.com, we cover the voter suppression and the decades-long effort from Jim Crow and onward, especially now with the voter suppression efforts going on across the country in state legislatures, especially Republican state legislatures, photo ID restrictions that bar people from voting, even though they are legally registered voters and should be allowed to vote, mm-hmm. all of the different ways that voters are being suppressed across the country. So not only do you have to register and vote, but you have to get your friends and your family and every single person you know on the planet registered and voting and with the correct materials so that when they do show up at the voting booth on, you know, in 2016, whenever there's an election, that they can actually complete their vote and get it counted. Because there's a huge push right now. And this is not just from, you know, the think tanks who mm-hmm. and the Koch brothers network, the AstroTurf network that's been funded by the fossil fuel companies to spread disinformation. The same groups of people are also funding voter suppression groups to prevent folks from going in and changing to the world that we could have. So that's I think where we are. You know, when you reverse engineer from getting rid of campaign the way we have it now with mm-hmm. Citizens yeah. United, and when you reverse engineer from trying to get campaign finance reform, it all comes back to the vote and getting as many people to vote as possible.
Yeah, because it's the only way to do it is to get those candidates there and to get them elected that you know have been standing for that for a very long time. And you can read about your candidates and you can see who their contributors are. I mean, you can look at how they've been living their lives in office and you can see if they represent the values that you care about. I think the other major push for getting out the vote is the youth vote. Because it's one of those things that, like, we say it all the time, and I know we sound like broken records, but like, the most progressive, the most kind of turn everything on its head people that have those values, that want to see this change, are the ones who aren't there actually pushing the lever in the voting booth. It's insane.
This is what my mom used to say. The world is run by those who show up.
Yes. And you know who's showing up? Old people.
Old scary people who don't want anything to happen, who think that, you know, we have an immigrant invasion from Mexico and that they're creating all these crimes and that, you know, the fossil fuel industries only have your best interests at heart. Yeah. I mean, these are the people who show up to vote.
Old, creepy, white men.
Yeah.
Who are sometimes kind of racist.
And really angry.
And really angry and don't want things to change. They think their country is being taken away from them. Who's it being taken away from? By you. They're afraid of you. So, like, show them why. Show up and vote. It's just that mentality. I think that we're just so cynical. It's so easy for young people to be cynical.
Oh, sure.
And then they kind of finally come around to it. But when they come around to it, they realize that it's maybe It's not too late. It's later than it should have been.
Yeah.
You know,
it's later than you think.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it takes an Obama type. I mean, we saw what happened in 2008. It was insane. It was amazing. Like, so many people showed up.
Yeah.
And the voter turnout in the youth group was like so much higher than it had been in the past. We had people, I remember, I was in college then. I was in grad school, actually. I had just started my PhD. But I was still pretty young, maybe like 23 or something, living in New York. And I took buses every weekend to Philadelphia to go knock on doors.
Good,
you know,
for you.
To like, and it was, but it didn't even feel like a big thing. It was just like all my friends were doing, we all wanted to do it, you know, because there was like a fire under our ass. And I worry that Obama has let so many people down that he's stepping up his game here in the final, you know, in the final hours.
Sprint to the finish.
Exactly. Which is like, thank God, because we were all really worried for a while there. We were like, there's no reelection, man. What are you waiting for?
Yeah.
But now, like, so many great policies have been enacted. You know, we've got gay marriage coast to coast in this. I mean, that's a huge win. And it's an ideological win more than anything. I mean, it's a real win for so many real people.
Yeah.
But it's also a shift in the way that we're thinking and a shift in the way that I think the progressive underdog feels like, fuck, finally. We're not swimming upstream anymore.
Yeah, and it is starting to shift. I mean, yeah. I sense that it's starting to shift, you know, and I'm not exactly sure if it's because of where I focus most of my time and news gathering and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's wishful thinking on my part. But I don't know. It does seem like we're seeing a shift, you know, and any kind of shift is welcome, you know. And when we're talking about, you know, the mechanisms that will help get us to the place in policies and in our politics and in our infrastructure and, you know, moving forward, the things that it's going to take to get us where we need to be, you know, we need to have people come out and vote. And, you know, and it's a very well-established pattern that, you know, the youth vote comes out every 4 years in presidential elections.
Yeah.
And then they sit out the congressional elections. And that's why we have this back and forth, this one step forward, two steps back,
yep.
You know, because we have now, you know, Republican majority in the House and in the Senate in Congress. And that's why we can't get anything done, because everybody sat out the 2014 election. You know, if everybody shows up for 2016, great. But you also got to show up in 2018 when there's another round of congressional elections that are going to determine what your future is. Not just today, not just tomorrow, not just in 2020, but your future in 2030. And that's when the shit starts to really hit the fan. And how do we help people understand?
Yeah, because that does feel almost like a deficit model problem, because the truth of the matter is, I wouldn't be surprised if we, you know, for some sort of, maybe you'll see it coming up soon on YouTube, if we went out and did a video where we just interviewed, you know, people on the street,
yeah.
Young people over here on Melrose, right here in the heart of Hollywood, and said, you know, who makes laws in this country? Who's ultimately responsible? They might be like, the president? You know, they might not even really
right.
fully understand the kind of separation of powers in this country and the way that the government is structured. And that's what kind of worries me, is that the only way to rally people to get out is for them to understand why they're getting out. And so
yeah.
I think that we need a resurgence of a rock the vote kind of campaign.
Well, I mean, and I'm sure we will.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we will. I shouldn't be sure of anything in
yeah.
that case. You know, but you know, we have people who are visionaries and who are just also really good, like Elon Musk,
yeah.
for example. Elon Musk, exceptionally good at being a visionary and painting a picture of a world we want to have.
And being like a cool guy.
And
like,
a super
and
cool
so
guy.
That's so important, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of a badass, and young people are like, man, that's a cool guy. Like, I want to listen to what he has to say. I mean, never underestimate the power of that.
Yeah.
Of somebody who resonates with you, and they can just be like, dude, why aren't we voting? Like, that's totally lame. Science is cool. So
maybe we need to get Elon Musk to come out and talk about it.
Exactly. I bet you he would too. I bet you he'd
would.
Be down.
Yeah.
yeah. And I think that we also, you know, I know it sounds silly, but it's kind of how we opened this talk. And I think in a way, it's a good way to sort of, we're not quite ready to close it, but it's a good sort of coming back to that beginning point, which is the power of storytelling
yeah.
is so strong. Like, my boyfriend and I just last night, we were flipping channels. So there's like, we're in that summer doldrums of like, there's no good TV on. And so we're like, ah, fuck, there's nothing in the DVR. And so we started looking through, like I always do, my Netflix queue and my HBO queue of documentaries. And, you know, I have like 40 documentaries that I'm a documentary fiend. And I was like, how have I not seen Virunga yet? Let's watch Virunga.
Virunga, which is this, I don't know this one.
It's amazing. It lost out to Citizen 4 last year for the Academy Award. And I will say this publicly. I think that obviously if you've followed any of my work, I think that the whole Edward Snowden saga is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a cornerstone of a lot of the work that I've been doing over the past couple of years about privacy issues and about, you know, basic human rights. That being said, I did not really like Citizen 4 as a documentary.
Really?
I thought the production was kind of shit. It was like also not the story, not the part of the story that was interesting to me. It didn't really talk about all the ramifications or the implications.
Put into a context,
not
a human
at all.
Context.
To me, it was literally just footage of Snowden sitting in a hotel room waiting to see if he was going to get like extradited. So anyway, I am kind of like weirded out that Poitras's documentary won. Maybe it was one of these things where it was like, this is more of a symbol for all the other journalistic work she's done, which is kind of unfair.
It's more
for
about
the
idea rather than the production itself.
Exactly. And for all of the amazing work that she did,
yeah.
You know, in
and,
her
and,
actual...
And it has been, you know, and not to discount any of that, but yeah. You know, when you're talking about an Academy Award, part of it is supposed to be about the filmmaking of
totally.
It.
Totally. And it was, I just did not think that it was a well-made film. That being said, so it was up against Virunga, and Virunga lost, but it did get a lot of press, I think, around them, partially because Leonardo DiCaprio was an executive producer, and when there's a name attached to it, I think that means a lot. One of my favorite documentaries of all time, God Grew Tired of Us, about the Lost Boys of Sudan, which is fucking incredible. I think Brad Pitt was a producer on it, and I think that that's why people saw it.
Like, sure.
So Virunga, people saw, but if you haven't seen it yet, go to Netflix. It's on Netflix right now.
What's it about?
It's about this national park in the Congo that is being protected, and it seems on the offset that it's about the forest gorilla. Is it called the forest gorilla? Shoot. Mountain gorilla. Yeah. There's 800 left. They only live in this area of the Congo. And so it kind of seems sort of like the whole focus of the documentary is this gorilla, you know, it's on the cover art, blah, blah, blah. But it's so much deeper than that. It's about this group of incredible people who are working to protect this national park from all the interests that want to invade it. And this subplot of, I think they're called Soco, which is a British oil company.
Okay.
And they wanted to move in. They wanted to start drilling for oil. They kind of were starting to get intertwined with the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. There were a lot of bribes going on. There was a lot of under the table illegal stuff going on. There's some amazing investigative reporting in this documentary where you see hidden camera footage. This one woman, she had to be 23 years old on her own in the Congo going out and like secretly filming meeting, like so inspirational. And then you see these incredible men and women who are working to protect the forest, and their central goal is the health of the animals there and the preservation of nature, of this gorilla. There's also an orphanage where they have some gorillas that were orphaned by poaching, where they're raising them. So there's this amazing kind of subplot of watching these gorillas being taken care of.
That puts it into context.
It totally does. And then you see the kind of stress, and you start to really understand the tension between pure environmental motives and monetary motives, and how powerful money can be, how powerful greed can be. And you even look at some of the bribes that were made, and in your mind, you're like, that guy made $45,000.
That's it.
Like, you're kind of like, what the fuck?
He sold everybody down the river for just $40,000.
But at the same time, then you understand really what poverty is like in the Congo, and how it's not like you can't blame these people. Of course you can blame these people, but the power of money is so much stronger when you have none of it.
Yeah.
And so when an oil executive comes in that says, oh, we're doing everything lawfully, we're doing everything legally, we want to drill for oil and it'll bring prosperity to the whole region, when you know that's not going to happen. It's happened so many.
But how would they know that?
It's sad because they kind of should but shouldn't, because Congo just generation after generation has been destabilized by foreign interests coming in and bribing.
Corruption.
Totally corrupted people, foreign interests coming in, either saying we want to own your ass and being sort of imperialistic, or coming in and saying, look at this financial venture, and then bribing and working hard with the government. And it just, the minute you have stability, it gets undermined again.
And it's the resource curse.
It's the resource curse. And they are rich in resources and they have been just mined. And I usually don't use this word lightly because I think it's not a good word to use out of context, but just raped.
Yeah.
Completely. And so this film is so much more than that plot, because just like what we were talking about, the power of storytelling to show you the tension of pure environmentalism and saving nature and animals for the sake of it. Because I say, oh, there's only 800 left. We do everything we can.
Right.
That's fucking crazy that we're about to lose this majestic. I mean, it's a great ape. It's a species that's, there's only six of them that are kind of like us. Five, actually. The sixth is a lesser ape, the gibbon. But that's just like us, you know? Yeah. And how could we lose something like that? But drilling.
Do people make the connection between, you know, the lifestyle that you have today, you know, when you drive down the street and you go to the grocery store or you go to the gas station, not you, obviously, because you've got
I don't have to anymore. Yeah, but I did for many, many years.
You know, but let's, you know, how it's drawing that line between, you know, because Americans are, I think, overall good people.
Of course.
You know, lovely people. I have never met anybody, you know, that I can't say, my goodness, Americans are great.
And values are so important.
Yeah. And when they have the information, they make the right choice. You know, they don't want to hurt anybody. They want everybody to be okay. They want everybody to be safe. You know, and when you make that connection between, hey, you know, your lifestyle, that oil for your lifestyle, that comes from the Congo.
Yeah. That comes, from areas
that comes
where
from Nigeria. That comes from all these places where, you know, that portion of the world has this resource, this vast, wonderful, rich resource, and yet they're being stripped of it and decimated by it.
That's why you can afford your gas.
Yeah.
You know, your gas is so cheap.
The high cost of your lifestyle and how it actually, it's low to you, but it's high to everybody else.
It's
and helping
very
people
high.
See that through line. You know, and one of the other things, real quick, because I'm not...
No, of course.
Okay. So, with the Pope's encyclical, you know, the big encyclical talking about how we have to be stewards of the environment, how we're raping the environment, how we're, you know, turning it into an immense pile of filth is what he actually said, quote.
Oh, wow.
You know, one of the responses that came out of that from the climate change denial industry and their politicians was to say that the poor, the global poor, you know, around the world are still living in energy poverty, and environmentalists must hate the global poor because they want to prevent them from having the kind of cheap energy that they would need to have in order to lift themselves out of poverty. You know, and there is, it is true, you know, there is the global poor. There are about a billion people who have no electrical access to electricity at all. However, the coal industry has had decades to get out there and build some stuff for them to get to the grid in order to be able to have centralized grid access. And so far, they haven't bothered to do it.
Completely. This idea of like blaming the poor for their poverty.
Or blaming environmentalists for the poverty that the poor in the global world have, you know, and saying, well, you want them to have expensive renewable energy when they could have cheap coal. It's like, oh, so you want to shackle them to coal contracts that pollute them, that poison their children and poison their fish and poison their water. Mm. Oh, so that's what you prefer. You know, and of course, they don't really care about the poor. This sudden concern for the poor really is only about maximizing and continuing the fossil fuel industry.
And also, they don't need expensive renewables. Like,
see,
that's the thing
right.
that we don't, that people don't realize. Yes, in California, yes, in places where there's like massive infrastructure and we have so much we have to support.
It took decades to build.
Exactly. We need this kind of energy source that can sustain us in places where kinetic energy will do, where you can have a foot-powered washing machine, you know, where you can have low-tech solutions to these really big problems. We're not talking about, you know, putting solar panels on every, like, high, glossy, NASA-style solar panels on like a hut. Like, we're literally talking about thinking about how to help people be sort of self-reliant and utilize the types of, I think, really ingenious energy sources that can help you form your own community and take a stand. And they don't have to be tethered to to oil. They don't have to be tethered.
There
to
is absolutely
fuels.
No reason. No. In fact, they can leapfrog over the pollution phase of development. And there's, you should talk to David Roberts over at Vox.com, by the way. Everybody should look up everything that David Roberts ever writes.
Oh, great.
At Vox.
Okay, good, good.
And he did this great deep dive into utilities, not just the utility models here in the United States, which is a very important fulcrum on which we are going to shift to clean energy. So that's really important to understand the nuances and the complexity of that. But that said, going over to the global poor and how to bring access to electricity, you know, and all that it can do to lift people out of poverty and make their lives, quality of their lives better. He did a deep dive where he actually realized that grid energy, grid electricity, the building out of the grid is not necessary. In fact, it is actually going to delay and increase energy poverty by making them wait even longer. You know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road is how long it would take to build grid energy. However, they can have community solar right now.
Interesting. So it's kind of the idea
less price
that
too.
We think of as being really kind of revolutionary, which is like,
it's got to be like us.
It's like, have a solar panel on my roof and then that charges my car and I can actually get off the grid. We think of that as being like so forward thinking. This is actually a cheaper, safer,
quicker,
more reasonable alternative.
Yeah, you know, you can have a solar panel that then can be daisy chained as more revenue becomes available, daisy chained to other solar panels. So they can start with cell phones, then they can power a cell phone tower, then they can power a refrigerator where they can keep medicines. They can have solar lights with, you know, LEDs. You know, LEDs just have now come on the market in the last 5 years where they can run a light bulb at night so that kids can study off of one trickle charge solar panel.
Yeah.
You know, so we have the technology now, and then it's just now come online that can enable these people to not have to deal with grid power, polluting coal, polluting oil. They can actually do all of this in a small and organic, literally, you know, sort of starting small and then letting it grow with the community. So, you know, these arguments against action on climate change, all, they don't sound like, you know, intuitively that this doesn't make sense. I don't want these people to live in energy poverty, but I also intuitively get the idea that they don't have to have coal, do they? No, they don't.
Yeah,
so we can
actually
make a huge
argument.
Difference with this.
Yeah. And that's, we've got to remember that. We've got to take a step back sometimes and be skeptical and go like, who's telling me this? Why are they telling me this?
Yeah.
What are they trying to get out of this? And I don't think that there's anything wrong with being financially motivated. I think that motivation is so important.
It is a lever of human nature.
Of course.
Let's use the levers instead of working against the levers.
Yes. Like, we've got to be financially motivated. It's the way to build societies. It's the way to build economies. But it cannot eclipse ethics. And that's the one thing that I think that we forget. We get so wrapped up in financial motivations that there have been whole schools of thought, you know, trickle down economics, all these places where they're like, don't worry, the market will actually work out these ethical qualms. No, it won't. You know, medicine should not be market driven. Healthcare should not be a profit driven
enterprise
system.
Right.
Exactly. And there's just a handful of places where I think we've lost track. And that's another reason that I always recommend that people watch Robert Reich's documentary.
Yes.
What is it? Inequality for All? No.
Yes.
That is his.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because one of the main points that he makes in this documentary is that all economies and all free market economics, even the most kind of conservative free market economics, was built on regulation. There's no such thing as an unregulated economy. It's never existed in the history of economics. And no economic scholar would ever actually push for that. It makes no sense. The only way that markets can run is when you have these regulatory checks and balances inside of them. Otherwise, the whole thing would implode. And so, and that's just something that, again, we have this kind of appeal to authority in this country that we should have, that we need to have, because we're a very functional enterprise as a nation. We have the best scientists in the world. We have the best enterprise in the world,
engineers,
the best manufacturing, the best engineering. And so when you get to that level of such expertise, no longer can everybody understand what everybody else is doing. And we have to just kind of trust the people that say, hey, I know what I'm doing. I'm the expert on this. And it's really fucked up, I think, when people take advantage of that. It's really fucked up when you have political movements to kind of dupe the constituency into believing vapor. Because you think it promotes your agenda. And so I am looking forward to a future where we at least are, you know, we have a bit of that bullshit detector. That's why I'm such an advocate, and I know you are too, of improving science literacy.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
yes.
Because more than just knowing how photosynthesis works is the ability to go like, man, that sounds like bullshit to me.
Yeah.
Because when you know about science and you understand the scientific method, you can kind of sniff out bullshit. It's a cool thing that you get along with the process. And the more that I think the voters can do that, the more empowered they're going to be. So I'm looking forward to that future.
I am too. You know, it's some studies that have come out recently have been very sobering. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a story that came out just in last week that ExxonMobil, there was a 1981... let me backtrack. Okay, so mm-hmm. ExxonMobil has known about the impacts of CO2 on the atmosphere since at least 1981. And this just came out where one of their scientists that was with Exxon wrote an email to Ohio University in response to an inquiry. He says, yeah, I told them about it back in 1981. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since then they have been continuing, and I told them, you know, you guys should do something about this. You guys need to address this. And since then they have spent millions and millions of dollars funding climate change denial groups.
Yeah. Like they're paying money to suppress the knowledge that they always had.
Yeah.
And does this guy still work there?
No, he doesn't. So. He's retired now, but it was just, it's one of those big stories that come out and make people, if it had been said instead, 1981 email proves ExxonMobil knew about CO2 and climate change. If instead it had said Hillary Clinton knew back in 1981 that Bill Clinton was having an affair, that would be nationwide news right now. Mm-hmm. And yet we're not talking. I haven't seen anybody
talk about
this particular ExxonMobil expose. You know, and these are things that were known. You know, everybody knew ExxonMobil paid.
Cynical about it.
Right.
We're cynical. We're like, well, yeah, obviously.
But we are not seeing the major media cover this. Mm-hmm. And part of that, you know, when we're talking about storytelling and how important it is to get these stories out to the people in the real world, you know, the everyday Americans who actually do make the country work, keep the country, you know, as an engine that keeps moving forward, when the stories aren't getting out to them, that's where a big deficit is right there. And and when you look at the broadcast media and you look at newspapers and print, newspapers are doing a pretty good job of getting the information out about mm-hmm. climate change. You know, not great. They still have, you know, journalistic balance that they have to thread that needle. But when it comes to the broadcast media, just look at their advertisers.
Exactly.
They're primarily funded. Every break, you're going to see an fossil fuel industry image ad. You know, look what natural gas does for America.
Yeah, you're going to see fossil fuel industry. You're going to see pharmaceutical industry. You're going to see like kind of these big complexes.
Because they're the ones that can afford to pay the millions of dollars that then keep these networks and cable news networks running. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it comes time to get to the election, and we're already seeing campaign ads, you know, there is not a financial incentive for the networks, for the TV stations, for the cable networks. There's really no financial incentive for them to give free airtime to candidates to get their word out.
Yeah, you know how
the
they would do that?
The incentive is to get media advertising.
Yeah, you know how they should do that? Because the government should tell them they have to.
Right.
And that's the frustrating thing about vilifying regulation.
Right.
That's where I get really frustrated as a progressive, seeing people vilifying regulation. There's a reason that certain, you know, that when the government first owned the airwaves and we only had five, you know, 3 to 5 networks, that there was a certain percentage of time that had to be dedicated to informational programming that was not going to be based on profits. They made no money. They weren't allowed to. They just had to do it and use their profits from their other programming for it. And that model has gone by the wayside.
Well, Ronald Reagan dismantled the fairness doctrine. And so that's why we see the rise of Fox News, where, you know, they don't have to be fair. They don't actually even have to be accurate. There are court rulings regarding that. That's a whole other ball of wax where they actually don't have to even be honest. But that's where we are. And again, it's getting the story out so that people can understand what the actual parameters are that we're dealing with right now. And it all, again, how do you change that policy that requires the networks and the TV news industry to talk about what's actually happening and to not rely on, forcing candidates to pay for, you know, millions of dollars in campaign ads? How do you get to that policy? Oh, you have to get the people in Congress voted in.
Yep.
You have to vote. And you have to register. You have to get everybody you know registered and out to vote on election day.
So again, you do this kind of parallel track. On the one hand, you work so hard to rally to get the right people there. And since that does take time, you also continue to support independent media. You support independent media that you think is trustworthy.
That gets the story out.
Yeah, you do your research and you go there. And if CNN has, or 60 Minutes or whatever, have one too many times let you down, stop fucking giving them your attention.
Yeah.
Stop sharing their stories. Stop, you know, don't give them the Nielsen ratings. Don't turn your TV into it so that the advertisers will want to keep paying them to just churn out garbage that, you know, satisfies the advertisers. Keep going to these independent places that are, you know, Patreon funded or that are internet funded through different kinds of advertising models. And, you know, it's interesting because you really do have so much power with your vote and you have so much power with your wallet. And
If
you're in a position to show and to flex that muscle, I think that's a great thing to do. So we are running low on time, and I wanted to end with the same thing that I end all of my episodes with, which is the same two questions. I'm always interested to see people's answers. Something tells me I can guess what your answer will be to at least one of them, because you're only one of two people that I've had on the podcast so far, I hope I'm not shortchanging anybody, who really does focus on climate issues as a regular endeavor and as a part of your job. And so there's a very popular answer to this next question, and I'm interested to see your take on it. So in whatever context matters to you, whether it's personal, whether it's global, whether it's whatever, I want to know from you, what is the thing that you're so concerned about? What is the thing that keeps you up at night, you know, with regards to the future? And on the flip side of that, when you're thinking about the future, you know, what are you optimistic about? What are you looking forward to?
Well,
climate change.
Yeah.
Like, that was what the whole episode was about, wasn't
essentially,
it?
Essentially, yeah.
But it's interesting how it's the most common answer. Like, by far, everybody is really, really worried about climate change. So I want to see your take on it.
Yeah. My take is that that's what keeps me up at night. And nobody really wants to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where we are. But we can, that's the other thing that I'm optimistic about. Again, man-made problem means man-made solution. It is not out of our hands. So without going into too much depth as to why this is so worrisome, it is very worrisome.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think that the listeners of my podcast and the people who listen to your show, they know that. You know what I mean? These are the people who are hip and savvy to the fact that this is worrisome. I don't think most of the people listening right now think that climate change isn't real. I wouldn't be surprised if I do have a percentage, and if you have a percentage of listeners who are on the fence or who are in the kind of denial weeds and they're trying to figure things out. I think most of our listeners, though, are pretty progressive. They understand that this is a real problem. It actually keeps them up at night, too. But maybe that's the change that's needed. You know, I'm sick of sitting here going, this sucks.
Yeah.
And going, there's nothing I can do. Because there is something we can
do about it. Oh, there's a great deal.
Yeah.
That's the optimistic part, you know, when you think about so granted, we don't have jetpacks and flying cars now, but, you know, we are already now, I believe, firmly set on the path to clean energy. It's just a matter of how fast it's going to be. Yeah. And we can make that happen. You know, like you said, your dollar is your lever, and your vote is your lever, and everybody can do that. And not only that, you can be a Sherpa. You can be a Sherpa into this awesome, fabulous, wonderful, exciting new world for all of your friends and family who aren't there yet, who need your help, who need you to lead them and say, hey, this is what's going on and it's going to be great.
Yeah. And you don't have to be, you know, it doesn't need to be financially, what's the word I'm looking for? there doesn't have to be a line in the sand financially. Like, if you can't vote with your dollar and if you can't go buy electric car, like, your voice is even more powerful than that.
Oh, totally. And you can help other people understand that, you know, and that's the only thing that ever really has made a difference is person to person. You know, you talking to your mom, you talking to your crazy right-wing uncle, you know, being the one to say, hey, you know, I realize that it's really scary what these people are talking about, you know, but it doesn't have to be scary. You don't have to consider it an attack on you personally. Just think of all the cool things that we're going to be able to do that we can have, you know, and we don't have to deal with all of this crap anymore.
Yeah, we don't have to feel guilty every time we turn the lights on. You don't have to feel guilty when you run your tap. If we can figure out how to have a sustainable model, and I think that we can. So I want to know from you where all of the listeners can find a Green News Report, where they can hit you up on Twitter, on Facebook, all of the things, because I think that you've been so kind of motivating and you've really helped me at least feel a glimmer of hope. And I think people who are listening are like, there are things I can do. Tell me more.
It's going to be really cool. Seriously.
So how can they learn more?
Okay, so all of our reports, we put out 2 a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they're only 6 minutes long. So they're really quick and easy, and you can, you know, take care of them and listen to them quick. And it's just headlines, you know, and a lot of snark, because there's lots to make fun of. And so that's greennews.bradblog.com. I also tweet out at Green News Report. At Green News Report, where, you know, I just also tweet, you know, news stories that are interesting and commentary. But, you know, that's also the first place where we tweet out when our reports are published. We're on Facebook, Green News Report. And what am I forgetting? Oh, also bradblog.com, which is, you know, the home site. And Brad Friedman, my partner and co-host on the Green News Report. We have a daily radio show called The Bradcast. And we also talk about these issues. And you can access that at bradblog.com. Again, greennews.bradblog.com. Bradblog.com is the main site. So you can just go to bradblog.com and be able to get all this stuff, too.
So many ways to find you.
Yeah. And we're on progressive radio stations all around the country and actually around the world, too. But God, I could not tell you when. So
that's when you go check your local listings.
Yeah, check your local listings, because it's hard to get. But yeah, we're and it's mostly on progressive and nonprofit radio stations, so that you can hear. But you can also hear it, like, we're on, you know, Minnesota KTNF. But God knows I couldn't tell you what time. So
Minnesotans who are listening,
there you
I know
go.
I have a bunch actually. So, man, Desi, thank you so much for joining. I always learn so much when I get a chance.
Well, thanks
to talk
for inviting
to you.
Me. I do too with you too. We like this, all this stuff. It's like once we turn off the mics, we keep talking.
I know. I know. It's so great. And I really hope, you know, I just first met Desi. I've known of Desi for so long, but we are regular fill-in hosts on TYT, on the Young Turks Network. And I think the reason that we kept not being together is because it's usually one or the other, because we fill in for Cenk or Anna. And then we had that opportunity when they were both out to just run the show ourselves. And it was so much fun.
I know. It was like, okay, can we interrupt our chatting now to do some news? Because we like talk about so much stuff and you're... all the stuff that you know about science, it's like, okay, if I need to understand how something works, I'm going to ask Cara.
Well, and so. I'm the same way with you, because I have, like, not a strong background at all in these environmental issues. You know, my background's in brain science. When I was at HuffPost, there was already an environmental page, so I never got to cover environmental news.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't my beat. And so I just learned so much when I talked to you. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for inviting me. This is hilariously fun.
It was so fun. I know everybody listening had a great time. And thank you so much for everybody that comes back week after week and supports the show. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.